can't find you at your usual table. Everything okay? From Lance to Gwen. You seen Art? From Gwen to Lance. No, you? From Elaine to Gwen. You need to get to the park by school. From Gwen to Elaine. Can't. Merlin's rambling about how much he liked my essay on the test and that I need to participate more in class. Won't stop talking. Literally texting behind my back right now. From Elaine to Gwen. Art just beat the crap out of Lance. From Gwen to Elaine. What? All caps. From Elaine to Gwen. Art said Lance started the joust, left Lance curled up in the dirt. Think he's crying. From Gwen to Elaine. Coming. All caps. From Gwen to Lance. Lance, you okay? Lance, text me you're okay. From Art to Gwen. Hi. What time should I pick you up tomorrow night? Saturday. From Lance to Gwen. Remind me to get beat up more often. From Gwen to Lance. All it took was some Chinese takeout and a Game of Thrones marathon. From Lance to Gwen. And you there with me. From Gwen to Lance. Please don't tell anyone about the stuff I said about my dad and our family. I shouldn't have talked about it. No one knows. From Lance to Gwen. I would rather be drawn and quartered than betray a secret from you. From Gwen to Lance. How romantic. From Lance to Gwen. Every second I spend with you is romantic. Except the you leaving super early this morning part. From Gwen to Lance. Stuff to do. From Lance to Gwen. What stuff? From Art to Gwen. Hey, Lance definitely started the joust, 'cause it got taken down last night. Sucks being lied to. Trusted that kid with my life. From Gwen to Art. Exactly how long have you two known each other? From Art to Gwen. A long time. Told him it was better if kids at school didn't know. This way we could do our own thing. From Gwen to Art. Maybe it wasn't healthy for you two to be that close. From Art to Gwen. Yeah. From Gwen to Art. Is that why you never asked me out? Because Lance liked me? From Art to Gwen. Lance would really freak out if you were my girlfriend, wouldn't he? From Gwen to Art. Well, forget Lance for a minute. Do you want me as your girlfriend? From Art to Gwen. I'm taking you to prom, aren't I? From Lance to Gwen. Ugh, fell back asleep. Haven't eaten all day, but too sore to get out of bed. Need to brush my teeth. Art hasn't called or texted. Think me and him aren't going to prom. Ha. From Gwen to Lance. Maybe it wasn't healthy for you two to be that close. From Lance to Gwen. Yeah, it's tough to drop someone you've known that long. From Gwen to Lance. People leave and enter your life for a reason. From Lance to Gwen. Yeah, they do. Smiley face. Well, at least there's one silver lining to all this. Dot, dot, dot. From Gwen to Lance. What's that? From Lance to Gwen. You and I can go to prom now. From Gwen to Lance. You're not going to prom. You need to stay in bed and rest up. Dr. Gwen's orders. From Lance to Gwen. Will you rest up with me? From Gwen to Lance. What was that about still needing to brush your teeth? From Lance to Gwen. That got me out of bed, haha. Wanna come over around 6? Craving pancakes. Gonna hit Griddle Cafe. From Gwen to Lance. The one on Benwick Avenue? From Lance to Gwen. Nah, Corbin Street. From Gwen to Lance. Okay, wait until later. Line is probably long. From Lance to Gwen. Too late. Pulling up. Ah, no line at Griddle, but it's a mess at the salon next door. All the girls getting their hair done for prom. One looks just like you, LOL. From Gwen to Lance. Lance, I'm sorry. Please pick up. From Lance to Gwen. You're going to prom with Art after he beat me up for a joust that you started? All caps. From Gwen to Lance. Look, he asked me to go, and I couldn't say no. It's just a dance, okay? From Lance to Gwen. All this time, I didn't think I was worthy of you, but now I see you're not worthy of me. You and Art will make a perfect pair. From Gwen to Lance. Lance, I'm sorry. From Lance to Gwen, we're done. Don't ever text me again. From Gwen to Art. Hey, I think you should make up with Lance. You two were best friends. Don't let it fall apart over something stupid. From Art to Gwen. Something stupid? He humiliated me. Let him rot in hell. But I'll thank him for one thing. He brought you and me together. From Gwen to Art. He's your real friend, Art. Not me. From Art to Gwen. You and Lance have very different definitions of what it means to be my friend. Smiley face. Pick you up at 6. From Gwen to Lance. I can't do this anymore. I want to tell Art I started the joust, but if I tell him, he won't go to prom with me, and he needs everyone to see him at prom with me. What do I do? From Gwen to Lance. Lance, please talk to me. From Art to Gwen. Almost at your house. From Elaine to Gwen. Everyone, all caps, is talking about how hot you two look. People are like stepping out of the way for you guys. And when you danced, everyone stopped dancing and just watched. Like you're royalty or something. You killed it, Gwen. Every girl here wants to be you. From Gwen to Elaine. Thanks. From Elaine to Gwen. Where are you? Don't see you. From Gwen to Elaine. Bathroom. Needed a minute. From Elaine to Gwen. Hurry, announcing prom king and queen soon. Art's standing here alone. Other girls chatting him up. From Gwen to Elaine. Yeah, coming. From Art to Gwen. Where are you? They're bringing out the crowns. From Gwen to Art. Do you love me, Art? From Art to Gwen. Did you pregame too hard? LOL. Get over here. From Gwen to Art. You don't even know me. From Art to Gwen. Of course I do. Why do you think you're my date? I really like you. From Gwen to Art. Tell me things you like about me. From Art to Gwen. I like your blonde hair. I like your blue eyes. All of it. From Gwen to Art. You have blonde hair. You have blue eyes. You could be talking about yourself. What do you like about me? From Art to Gwen. You're a badass. Girls are scared of you and do whatever you say. Guys have the hots for you. You have power over people. You're not Persephone. You're Hades. From Gwen to Art. That's what you like about me? From Art to Gwen. No one would have messed with you the way Lance messed with me. You're not weak like me. I want to be more like you. Hurry, people asking where you are. From Gwen to Art. You don't know me. I'm not strong. I'm not strong at all. From Art to Gwen. Definitely too much bubbly. From Gwen to Lance. I made a mistake. From Art to Gwen. Elaine says you're in the bathroom. Do I need to come get you? From Gwen to Art. Just need a minute. From Gwen to Lance. I love you, Lance. I want to be with you, but I don't know how to be with you and still be me. From Art to Gwen. You locked the bathroom. Open the door. From Elaine to Gwen. WTF, all caps, question mark, question mark, question mark. Got them to delay crowning 5 minutes. Hurry, all caps. From Art to Gwen. I'm yelling through the door. Can you hear me? From Gwen to Lance. Lance, please. From Lance to Gwen. I'm here. From Gwen to Lance. What? From Lance to Gwen. Outside Camelot. Calling you, but line keeps dropping. Which tower are you in? From Art to Gwen. You okay in there? Janitor's getting me the key. Please answer me. From Gwen to Lance. Tower A, second floor bathroom. From Lance to Gwen. Open the window. I'll climb up and get you. From Art to Gwen. Got the key. From Lance to Gwen. Hear me? I'm calling your name. From Gwen to Lance. Can't hear or see you. Glass is thick and frosted on the inside. Where are you? From Lance to Gwen. Don't worry, I'm climbing up. Try opening it. From Gwen to Lance. I can't, it's jammed. From Lance to Gwen. Push harder. From Art to Gwen. You deadbolted the door. WTF, all caps. Gwen, open it. From Gwen to Lance. Art's ramming against the door. From Lance to Gwen. Gwen, you have to push harder. From Gwen to Lance. I can't do it. I can't just leave. From Lance to Gwen. Why? From Gwen to Lance. What about Art? From Lance to Gwen. Art has the whole world to love him. He always will. From Gwen to Lance. What do we have? From Lance to Gwen. Our own screwed-up little kingdom with a broke-down palace where nothing can stop us from being together. And I will stay up here, on this ledge, outside the window that you won't open while I text with one hand and hold on with the other until you get it through your thick skull. I love you, Gwen. Rich or poor, ugly or fair, young or old, inside and out. I love you. I love you. I love you. From Gwen to Lance. Catch me if I fall. From Art to Gwen. They pushed me on stage. I'm on stage, Gwen. In my crown. From Gwen to Art. My beautiful Art. You're right. I am Hades. Kidnapping your Persephone. But one day you'll look back and see that only someone as pure as you could bring together two broken souls. From Art to Gwen. What? Gwen, please. They're announcing you. I need a queen. From Gwen to Art. Long live Arthur. All hail the king. From Art to Gwen. Gwen? From Art to Gwen. Gwen! Samantha Lane's Villain Challenge to Soman Chainani. A modern-day mashup of the King Arthur legend and Persephone Hades myth. The Bad Girl Hall of Fame by Samantha Lane. Which bad girls are the baddest? Dread Persephone writes, "The choice was simple. I'd either be a maiden all my life, controlled by my overbearing mother, or I'd take an opportunity to escape to another world. Just didn't expect to transform myself into a formidable queen, more feared than my husband." Hashtag, sorry, not sorry. Comments. Samantha Lane commented on your post. Coming-of-age tales and villain origins have a lot in common. Teens are fighting for their independence and against familial pressures. Villains are frequently fighting against societal and moral expectations in their origins. One of the reasons I love the Persephone myth is that she combines both. Though I do not view her as a villain, many do, as she is associated with death. Villains' backstories are all about opportunities and choices. Throughout, we are shown the various crossroads where they could have turned back and continued to live a life of good. We, the audience, are torn between wanting them to cross over to the dark side and hoping that maybe this time they won't. Characters with agency are more complex, which is why I love them so much. Villains do horrible things, and we still root for them in spite of that. We are drawn to people who make mistakes, like us. Very few of us are stalwart and true 100% of the time. Villains represent what we cannot and will not do in real life. As I see it, Persephone made a series of choices that led to her becoming one of the most feared goddesses in the pantheon, instead of continuing to live a simple life with her mother. In Gwen and Art and Lance, Gwen made the choice to be with someone who her high school society viewed as the wrong choice. Villainy is liberating. Born Wicked writes, "Am I really so wicked? Or did the world paint me that way simply because I am different? And if I am wicked, was I born that way or made wicked by the world's reaction to me?" Samantha Lane commented on your post. The other route for villains is the view that they are simply victims of circumstance, that they have been tricked into becoming villains by fate or by those around them. This question has been explored by modern retellings time and time again. Are some people just destined to become villains, and they don't have a choice in the matter at all? Historically, fairy tales and myths took this route, depicting people as either good or evil for no reason. But modern society has turned away from the view of passive characters and wants characters to be active participants in their destiny. In Gwen and Art and Lance, Gwen takes an active role in what unfolds. She manipulates the situation around her to suit her needs and doesn't apologize for it. She isn't simply along for the ride, but is in charge of the entire operation. Killer Singers writes, "Once handmaidens, we have been reborn. Now we serenade you, tempting you to join us." All caps. Samantha Lane commented on your post. Origin stories are all about transformations. In stories of the past, we saw characters being physically transformed into villains or monsters. Medusa was once a beautiful woman. Anakin Skywalker had to be burnt to a crisp and don a mask in order to complete his transformation into Darth Vader. But physical transformations aren't the only way villains are made. In Gwen and Art and Lance, Gwen has transformed herself into the It Girl at her school. She has skillfully climbed the social hierarchy of high school and manipulated those around her to get what she wants. Villains' monstrousness, either physically or through their personalities, provides an excellent mirror for the hero. The better and more complete the transformation into a villain is, the better the hero has to be in order to defeat them. Camelot Gwen writes, "Can a beloved hero become a villain? Can a villain turn out to be the hero?" All caps. Samantha Lane commented on your post. We like our villains powerful, and one manifestation of power is narrative control. Who decides who the villain is and who the hero is? In Gwen and Art and Lance, Gwen takes power by being in control of information and withholding information to fit the narrative she wants. Over the years, our society has become fascinated with characters who are not fully evil or fully good, but instead lie somewhere in the middle. Our obsession with anti-heroes and anti-villains is a result of social ideals being rewritten. We are unmaking the concept of wickedness. As the popularity of the heroes in Batman, The Punisher, and Suicide Squad shows, the lines between heroes and villains have become blurred. There is no clear distinction between hero and villain anymore, which is the theme that modern stories and retellings are exploring.
Shirley and Jim by Susan Dennard. To Gene Watson. From Shirley Holmes. This story begins with a kiss from my family's pool boy. His name was Antonio. He was cute, and I liked the way a dimple formed in his right cheek whenever he smiled. I was also super curious about kissing, so even though he was almost 18 and I was only 14, I thought, what the hey? Opportunity was knocking, and you know me, once I've set my mind to something. Well, the kiss was too sloppy, and for the record, tongues are gross. So that one exchange of saliva was more than enough to turn me off from kissing and from boys forever. Or at least for a while. Not that it mattered to my dad. He caught me, see? And holy what's it, William Holmes was on the phone with Headmistress Hudson an hour later, and the next morning I was on my way to Baker Street Preparatory School, where young minds grow into brilliance. That's what the brochure says. Have you ever looked at it, Jean? I think that's the back of your head on the last page. No exaggeration, though. The very next morning, I was out of my family's estate and moving into that dormitory with you. Meaning, as you've no doubt deduced by now, that the story I told you about pissing off a Mr. Antonio at my last school was a total lie. The first one I ever told you, Jean, and the only one until our senior year. The truth is, I was embarrassed about that kiss with pool boy Antonio. Plus, I wasn't very popular at my first high school, my personality being, what is it Headmistress Hudson always says? Abrasive. So Baker Street Prep seemed like the perfect chance to reinvent myself. A rebel with a capital R. That was what I wanted to be. Someone who didn't do what the establishment expected. Someone who didn't do what her daddy expected. And I know, I know, I never convinced anyone of that image. Least of all myself. Fall semester, senior year. That was when a true rebel showed up, and a pecking order established in the ninth grade was suddenly obliterated by a mysterious newcomer. It was lunch when he arrived. We were in the cafeteria, remember? I was lecturing you about why you were never going to pass AP Bio if you kept mixing up pneumaticists and nematicists. I'm sorry about that, Jean. Looking back, I was such a condescending a-hole, a.k.a. my dad. First came Headmistress Hudson, bustling into the drab dining hall with her usual animation. She pushed through the pizza line, boys, and then the salad line, girls, like Moses at the Red Sea. Then a collective gasp crossed the cafeteria, all the way over to our shadowy table, remember? Right as I was getting to the best part on Cnidarian morphology, you twisted around to look. Holy crap, you said. I hope he's a senior. I followed your gaze, and my lungs hitched. Until that moment, Jim had been blocked by Headmistress Hudson's bouffon. Holy crap, I thought. I hope he's a senior. I don't know how to explain it. Nothing about Jim Moriarty looked that good. Fitted jeans and a flannel button-up, totally hipster. Thick-framed glasses, not in style anymore. Dark hair, all sideswept and dramatic, definitely not achieved without product. Yet the instant the school turned its gaze upon Jim Moriarty, everyone sat a little taller. Then, in a bolt of lightning, rumors raced through the hall. Whispers of, I heard he got expelled from his last school for hacking into the computers and changing his grades, and he got arrested for erasing all of a bank's digital debt records, and, the only one that actually sounded plausible, his parents died in a car crash and his uncle raised him. Even his name, Jim Moriarty, just oozed bad boy, or gothic hero along the lines of Mr. Rochester and Heathcliff. Or maybe even one of those vampires who girls are always falling for on the CW. I was hooked. Immediately. Like everyone else at Baker Street Prep, I wanted Jim's swagger. I wanted Jim's boredom. I wanted his lazy smile and complete uninterest in school, the students, the world. He was everything I could never be, don't you see? Like, do you remember how he waltzed into AP Bio the next day, took the exam, the one we'd crammed for all night, and then waltzed right back out with 15 minutes to spare? Ms. Adler didn't stop him. She just watched him saunter away, hands in his new uniform pockets. She didn't stop him the next day either, or any of the days Jim abruptly vanished. None of us did. We all just watched him go, thoroughly jealous that he could live by some internal clock only he heard. We guessed he went off to smoke cigarettes or snort Adderall, but we were wrong. Jim Moriarty went to the library. I know, Jean, because I went there with him. It was October. First week, third period. Jim had been at Baker Street Prep for almost a month. I had study hall that period, but rather than go to our dorm to practice the violin, as I should have done, I'd gone to the library. I used to go all the time, alone, when the procrastination bug hit or I was keyed up about an upcoming chess match. Now, I bet you didn't know this, Jean, but there's a chess table in the farthest corner of the library. Like, if you go past the main space with the cathedral ceilings, then circle around that lounge area with the armchairs that have more holes than leather, and you finally duck through those really tall bookcases on the right, the ones that are so close together your shoulders almost touch either side, you'll find the board. It's beside a dusty window. Seriously, I don't think it's been washed in a decade. There's an almost as dusty chessboard with two armchairs on either side of the table, mostly still leather since no one ever uses them, lit by a sad little wall sconce flickering overhead. I'm like 99% positive that until Jim Moriarty came along, I was the only person who knew that chessboard was there. I mean, the narrow shelves hold books in French and Spanish and German. And let's be honest, don't no one read in French or Spanish or German unless it's for class. So there I sat, staring at the board in a makeshift Bowden's mate pattern. The chess match against Scott's Yard High was still a few months away, but I'd been reliving last year's ass-kicking almost every night. Seriously, I would see pawns and bishops and Bowden's mate in my sleep. The landscaping crew was outside, hazy figures with wide-brimmed hats and a lawnmower that needed a new carburetor. At least, that was my diagnosis based on the hum, 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 hum sound it made. The crew had just scared the house sparrows from their nest above the window, and I was watching those dark, winged shapes swoop and swirl when a voice said, "Black Bishop to F5. I jumped. I might have screamed, too. It was actually really embarrassing, but in my defense, no one ever came back there. I mean, I was so accustomed to being alone, I'd actually pick my nose sometimes. I snapped my gaze to the shelves. Jim was standing there, with one of those little half-smiles he does, where only the left corner of his mouth toes up. Elusive, that smile. "Can I play?" he asked, motioning to the black side of the board. I nodded dumbly, and Jim glided into the empty armchair. Leather squeaked, making him smile with both sides of that perfect mouth now. He was amused, an emotion I wouldn't have known Jim Moriarty could feel, yet there he was, grinning. At me. He set a book on the floor beside the chair. I hadn't noticed he was holding it since I'd been so focused on hiding the tremble in my hands. Madame Bovary, it read. Par Gustave Flaubert. Is it good? My voice was shamefully tight, but can you blame me? There was a hot, mysterious guy who could read in French and who wanted to play chess with me. Things like that had never happened to Shirley Holmes.
The story's okay,
was Jim's vague reply, neither a yes nor a no. His gaze had already settled on the board, his forehead knitting down the middle in a way I would soon come to recognize, to look forward to, because that furrow meant he was playing chess. With me.
It's also a scary story,
he said at last. How so? I shifted my weight to move my hands beneath my thighs. They were still shaking, the bastards.
It's about a woman who spends her whole life believing in fairy tales.
His dark eyes flick to mine. Then, in a move that would have set the whole school to sighing, he eased off his glasses. He looks younger without them. Those thick black frames do a lot to hide his real face. Plus, they leave two red marks on the bridge of his nose whenever he takes them off. Something about those marks made him seem vulnerable, exposed. I swallowed.
What's wrong with believing in fairy tales? Reality will never live up.
Oh. This conversation had quickly moved out of my depth. Yes, you did read that right, Jean. I'm admitting there was something I don't know better than everyone else, and I'm admitting that I felt, gasp, uncomfortable by it. But then Jim made his move, knight to F3, and I was back in my element. He'd made a mistake, see? Not an amateur move, he clearly knew how to play, but definitely not an advanced move either. I wasn't about to go easy on him just because I thought he had nice eyes and was quite possibly the coolest person who had ever lived. Instead, I slid my bishop diagonally two squares before settling back to let him stare and frown and stare some more. The rest of the game unfolded in silence. A short game, because I slaughtered him. Like, I had his king in about 10 moves. Checkmate, I declared, sitting higher, puffing out my chest, preening, as you always accuse me of doing. He laughed then, a sound that would have slayed the school. It slayed me. Such surprise, such deep delight. Then he was slipping his glasses back on and smiling full wattage.
Play again tomorrow?
Deer in headlights, all I could do was muster a nod.
Good.
He pushed to his feet, swooped up his book, and headed for the tunnel of shelves, but at the edge, he glanced back.
See you tomorrow, Holmes.
It was such a light tone, playful, flirty, and leaving me with no clue how to reply. See you tomorrow, Moriarty, was a mouthful, and see you tomorrow, Jim, was what everyone else in the world would say. So I offered up a smirk and said, see you tomorrow, James. As soon as the reply left my lips, I was cringing inside. No wonder no one ever invited me to the winter formal. I could not, and still cannot, flirt. But Jim laughed, that same surprised burst of sound. Sure, it was now muffled by walls of foreign literature, but I, Shirley Holmes, had made him laugh. Twice. Jim and I played every day after that. He got better. So did I, though. Especially during the third week of October. Halloween was coming up, and Jim had commented on the heat wave right as we sat down to play.
It's weird, he said,
squinting through the dirty glass at a sunny afternoon.
Halloween should be cold and rattling with leaves, or at the very least, kind of cool outside.
Thanks, global climate change. I moved my pawn to A4. Seriously, though, James, get used to it. It's never cold here, so if you're looking for a white Christmas, you'll have to head up north. The only Decembers I've ever lived through hotter than these were when my family lived in Johannesburg. I was showing off a little, hoping he'd ask about my South African mama. He did. Score! So I relayed my go-to story about that time baboons broke into my grandmother's kitchen and crapped everywhere.
Your family sounds cool,
he offered at the end of the tale. His face, his tone, they were withdrawn, sad almost, and I hoped, hoped, hoped he would talk about his family, or anything at all to do with his past or where he'd come from. I mean, had his grandparents died in a car crash? Had he been expelled for changing grades? The latest rumor was that his uncle used to work for the CIA before leaking classified files and then vanishing off the grid, and while I did find a Gregory Moriarty who'd done all that, yeah, Jean, I Googled him. I couldn't confirm he was Jim's uncle. And Jim certainly didn't reveal anything about it. Instead, his gaze tipped back to watch me from the bottoms of his eyes. A hard gaze that set my hands to shaking again. Were I someone else, I'd have offered up some kind of sexy move. I'd have flashed a coy smile or batted my lashes or giggled knowingly. That's a thing, right?
Basically, I'd have done anything other than what I actually did, which was to turn red-faced and plop my knight to a stupid spot on the board.
"You want to be a lawyer,"
he said eventually, attention still on me. It was his turn in the game, but he wouldn't break that stare.
"Your friend Gene Watson mentioned it."
My lips puckered to one side. He had spoken to you about me. That had to be a good sign, right? Also, why did you never mention this to me, Gene?
"I mean," I said with a shrug, "I've always planned on being a lawyer. You know, go to Harvard, like my dad."
"Why?" His eyes finally returned to the board, and I finally breathed again.
"Are you just really passionate about heretofores and notwithstandings?"
"No," I huffed a chuckle, heat rising up my neck. "I want to help people, actually."
"You mean you want to help your wallet?" he countered. "Or maybe it's your daddy's wallet."
"It's not like that," I insisted. Yet even as the argument flew out, I knew that it was like that. Still, I floundered on. "My dad uses the law to win justice for victims, so I want to do the same."
"But you do know that at least 10,000 convictions are wrong each year. Sounds to me like the criminals," he air-quoted that, "are the bigger victims there."
"Come on now." I leaned on my knees. "What about the convictions that are actually right? What about the people who really need help, and it's up to their lawyer to make it happen?"
"Please, Holmes."
He made a face, a frowning, disappointed thing.
"It's never that simple, is it?"
Were he my father making that expression, I'd have instantly shriveled. Were he Ms. Adler, or the headmistress, or basically anyone in the world, I'd have rolled right on my back with my tail between my legs. And honestly, if you'd asked me a few minutes before this happened, how would you react to Jim Moriarty's disappointment? I'd have expected to shrivel. I mean, I was crushing on him so hard. But instead, I found heat building in my belly, found my fingers tightening around my bishop, my knuckles paling as I squeezed. And as Jim continued,
"Most people don't steal or kill or sell drugs because they want to, Holmes, or because they love being bad guys so much. They do it because they're born to a life with no exits, no chances. Unlike you or me, they can't just walk through walls."
"Walk through walls? Squeeze, squeeze, squeeze. What does that even mean?"
"It means you're lucky to be where you are, who you are."
Abruptly, he shot to his feet, the chair groaning back across the floor.
"Wait here."
In three long steps, the towering bookcases swallowed him whole. And I just sat there, inexplicably furious. I wanted to smack him, or to break his bishop in two. I mean, no one had ever told me that the law was a stupid career path to follow. And no one had ever accused me of doing it for the money, either. Jim returned in under a minute.
"Here."
A book fell onto my lap, worn hardcover, barely taller than my hand and no thicker. Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Chronicle of a Death Foretold, the English translation.
"Read it," Jim ordered, "and tell me who's guilty at the end. Tell me who you, as a lawyer, would lock away."
"And should I write a 5-paragraph essay on it too, Professor Moriarty?" I shoved a pawn to H3. "Or will there be a pop quiz tomorrow?" He sighed and settled back into his seat.
"You don't have to read it. I just think it's a good book, okay?"
I didn't answer. It was childish of me, that sullen silence, not to mention totally irrational. "Yes, I can be abrasive, Jean, but you know me. I don't ever let my temper come out. I make mistakes when I'm mad, and mistakes are for people who are not the offspring of William Holmes." I moved my pawn to E5, a move as foolish as they come. I mean, instantly, the whole game unraveled for me, and in about 15 turns, Jim said, "Check." A minute passed, during which I only managed to expose my king all the more, and when he finished with,
"Checkmate, Holmes,"
all I could do was glare. Remember that night I woke you up because I was crying? I told you the book I was reading was sad, which was a lie. I mean, Chronicle of a Death Foretold wasn't meant to be sad. It was supposed to be a commentary on who's truly to blame,
those who commit a murder or the village that does nothing to stop it. Yet underneath, tangled between its sentences and its beats, there was a love story. A girl, Angela, whose life was controlled by the men around her. A girl whose worth was based on what she could give. A girl who finally found what she wanted in life. But she was too late to claim it, leaving only one end for everyone. A senseless death foretold. I didn't tell Jim I had cried reading the book. I simply said, "The whole village was guilty," when I eased into my armchair the next day. The landscapers were right outside our window, weed hacking and hedge trimming in a roar of engines and snapping branches. We were halfway into our game before they passed, and I was finally able to add, "The townsfolk knew the brothers planned to kill Santiago, but no one intervened."
"So who gets punished?"
"The brothers."
"Even though everyone around them was just as guilty?"
"Well, the village didn't stab Santiago 20 times until his intestines fell all over the dirt. That was Angela's brothers." A shake of Jim's head, but not with annoyance. His eyes were crinkling behind his glasses as he jumped his knight forward to take my pawn.
"You're way too smart for the law, Holmes. Too smart to believe in things that aren't real."
I slid my rook to d4, claiming a black knight. "And how is justice not real, James?"
"None of it is."
He waved to the board.
"Not the rules? Not the game?"
He jerked his head toward the window, hair flopping with that gut-wrenching perfection.
"Not the prune trees or keeping up with the Joneses. Least of all that legal system you plan to get a degree studying. They're just myths. Giant lies that we all agree to believe in. And the only reason they hold power over us is because we let them."
I'll admit that my jaw fell open a little. Then, in a move of ultimate poise and eloquence, I said, "Huh?" And Jim laughed. Maybe it was the 10th laugh, or maybe the 100th that I'd conjured from him, yet it was this laugh that sent me tumbling head over heels. Yet even though I was falling, so fast and with so much blood roaring in my ears, the idiocy of Jim's next move, Black Queen to e6, allowed my brain to operate, my mouth to articulate. "All those things, James, those myths, they give us order, a framework to live in."
"They also give us war, Holmes, and genocide and poverty and..."
A wave around the library.
"An upper class. Don't you see it? Shared mythology is what creates us versus them."
"So?" I dragged out the word to emphasize my complete and total confusion. "Do you want chaos, then? No school or government or games? Are you an anarchist, James?"
"Hardly, Holmes."
A snort.
"More like, let's just say that I want to find what's real. I want to feel it, whatever it might be. And then, while the rest of the world sits cozy and oblivious inside their glass houses, I will be walking through walls."
"Oh," I said with fake interest. "And how do you plan to do that, sir?"
"Same way I always do."
And there it was again, Jean, that sad, broken smile, though it vanished 2 heartbeats later as he rested his elbows on the table, steepled his fingers over the board.
"Want to know something about me, Holmes?"
"Yes," I breathed with far too much enthusiasm. He didn't notice. His eyes drifted down to the board.
"I came to Baker Street Prep for something, and once I find it, I don't plan on sticking around."
Everything inside me went cold. "What is it you're looking for?"
"A key,"
he said calmly,
"to a door that people don't want opened."
It was then that I saw the reality. He was the nephew of Gregory Moriarty, and just like his uncle, he wanted to whistleblow and declassify and expose people he thought had done wrong. Before I could dwell on what that might mean, or what key he might be looking for, he said,
"Oh, and checkmate."
I blinked, lost for a moment. I'd completely forgotten that a game still waged between us. But wait, hadn't Jim lost his queen to me a few turns back? I honed in on the black and white squares, and then groaned. Because, damn it, he'd used the same move that gets me every time. Bowden's mate. Bowden's freaking mate. Another month passed. The same routine unfolded each day. Me versus Jim, white versus black. Jim won more often, and I didn't even care. But now the walls were shrinking in. Then one day, we had our first stalemate. It was early December, the day I skipped fourth period orchestra, remember? I told you I had cramps, but the truth was that the chess game had run long. Dad had told my older brother Mike and me the night before that if we didn't close out our semesters with the highest GPAs, then we were officially uninvited from the family trip to Aruba. What a jerk, right? On top of that, Jim kept asking me questions about you, Jean. What's it like for her being a senator's daughter? Has she ever been to the Capitol? Does she ever talk about her mom's policies? I was jealous, and I was pissed. It was the basic recipe for Shirley losing at chess, which was why I ended up whittled down to just my king. In my defense, though, Jim wasn't much better off. He had only his king and a rook left. We were seriously stuck, and I was tired of running my piece back and forth across the board. "Stop chasing my king," I snarled. "If I saw a way to do that," he clipped back, "then obviously I would. How about instead you stop running away from my rook?" "Let's just draw, James. This game is never going to end otherwise." A pause. Then his eyebrows perked up with mischief.
"And what would happen if it never ended, Holmes?"
"I'd miss orchestra, which would be bad."
"Why? Will it trigger the apocalypse? Fire? Pestilence? Famine?"
"Ha ha." I snapped my king over a square, the same move I'd been making for a full 10 minutes. And he scooted his rook after, only to pause, fingers twirling across the jagged top. Then his lips curled up. He moved his rook diagonally. Yeah, not sideways, but diagonally. I blinked, then wagged my head like a cartoon who'd just been slapped. "You can't do that."
"Says who?"
"The rules."
"Which we know don't matter, Holmes. Not if we both agree to stop believing in them."
His grin spread wider and wider, and I knew from the hair prickling on the back of my neck that I had stepped right into his trap. But I didn't care, because my pulse was picking up speed, my stomach was spinning in a good way. This wasn't like that time I had salmonella. This was like that roller coaster at Universal Studios. And I wanted more of it. So when Jim next declared,
"From now on, rooks go diagonally, and kings can move like queens,"
I didn't argue. I simply settled into the new rhythm until at last I won. An hour later, right before the bell rang for the end of fourth period. And guess what? The apocalypse didn't come, and Mike told me Aruba sucked anyway. In January, Scott's Yard won the chess match. Of course. Dad was irate. Do you remember that phone call? You said you could hear his shouts from the girls' bathroom, but I didn't care. Oh, the chess team thought I cared. You should have seen how they hung their heads on the bus ride back to Baker Street, all of them bracing for my shouts. But I didn't shout. I was scarcely thinking about Scott's Yard, or how, yet again, I had fallen for effing Bowden's mate, my eternal curse that move. No. Instead, I was wrapped up in a new book from Jim. Pedro Páramo. A tale swirling with ghosts and purgatory and the lives that could have been. I loved the book, devoured it in a night. Even in all its magical realism and intangible betweens, it felt real to me, familiar. Yet the next day, I said, I hated it. It never felt grounded. A crooked smile. Jim knew I was kidding, but he didn't push me for a real reaction. He just eased his pawn to d6. A bad start for him, but I was feeling charitable that day. Plus, I didn't want the game to end. Not yet. Not after reading that book and putting the puzzle pieces together. Oh, don't you see? Jim is a ghost, forever just passing through. That day in the library, he was trapped in purgatory until he found whatever mysterious key he needed to move on. Meanwhile, I was just beginning to realize that one day I would blink a heartbeat too long and find that when my lashes had lifted, Jim was gone. I wasn't ready for that. Those stolen moments with him in the library had become precious to me. I'm sorry, Jean, and so ashamed to admit it, but it's true. We had built an entire world trapped in time, perfect in all its layers, in its dust motes and sunshine, in its broken carburetor to rattle above the sparrow's cries, in the stink of biolab hand sanitizer to burn over the must of old French pages. I knew our glass walls wouldn't last, and that had left my humor foul. What else do you have for me, Professor? Maybe something with a happy ending this time? Is that too much to ask? His eyes squinted, thoughtful and perhaps a bit pleased.
So no winter formal for you tonight, then?
Oh, I said with a flippant shrug. Is that tonight? Obviously I knew when it was, but no one had invited me, and I knew for a fact that no one had invited him either. I won't lie. I was afraid he might ask you to the dance, Jean. Ever since he plied me with those questions about the Watson family, I thought maybe he was into you. But now I see the truth. And I also see what an idiot I was. I'm not going, I added, just in case Jim wasn't aware of my solo status.
All right then, Holmes.
He nodded slowly.
I have a book in mind for you. Where's your dorm? I'll bring it.
Boys aren't allowed in the girls' wing.
Come now.
A smug bounce of those eyebrows.
As much as I love when you talk rules and regulations, I'm interested to see a different side of you.
He eased his queen to D7, dragging his thumb across the top, a caress I couldn't tear my eyes from. The movement set off the roller coaster inside me. My throat closed up. My stomach ached with need, loop after loop. And it wasn't Jim's words, as flirty as they'd been, that did it. It was the movement, the offer implied in his fingers against the queen. Why be what you're expected to be? You could be like me, Shirley Holmes, if you just tried. The thing was, as much as I wanted it, and as much as I hungered for rebellion with a capital R, I wasn't ready to be a ghost. Not yet. But I also wasn't ready to lose my world trapped between. So I smiled, cheeks on fire. Room 54, James. On the corner. But wait until after the winter formal starts, okay?
Your wish is my command, Holmes.
If only that had been true, Jean. If only that had been true. He came to the window, not to the door, as I had anticipated. You were, of course, at the winter formal with Marty, and I was sitting at my desk, pretending to do calculus homework. But I'd been staring at the same problem for an hour without getting anything solved. I put on makeup with you. Do you remember that? While you were getting gussied up for the dance, I made you show me how to create the illusion of cheekbones. Contouring, you called it. But as soon as you left, I wiped it all off. I was afraid Jim would notice and then make some comment on the myths of beauty. A tap at the window sent me jumping from my chair. The window was right above my desk, but I had the blinds down. I hadn't seen him approach over the sliver of roof right outside. I lifted the blinds, his face coalescing in the darkness, hazy and terrifying through the glass. I turned off the light before finagling open the window, and then he said only one thing.
Join me.
I didn't think twice about it. I didn't think about the rules, or the sharp angle of the roof, or the 40-foot drop beyond. I didn't even think about how awkward I looked, clambering onto my desk and squeezing through the window. But here's the thing I see now. We all want that vampire from the CW so badly that sometimes we forget sunlight kills. The roof is beautiful at night. The asphalt shingles glitter more than you'd expect. A fairy path that Jim followed while I followed Jim. First, we crossed the newer roof above the dormitories until that gave way to the moss-covered wood shingles of the original school. Jim was so comfortable and easy in his angled lope across the roof. Meanwhile, I moved as best I could, out of my element, but wishing this height, these shadows, and this magical guide could be mine. When at last Jim came to a stop, I recognized from the nest in the gutter and the dark shape of the hedges below that we were directly above our library nook. Jim turned to me, glowing in the starlight.
Let's sit on the edge.
A command in his tone, yet a question in the way he extended his hand, one I answered by giving him my own hand. His fingers were frozen to ice, but strong all the same. Jim crouched at the roof's lip. He helped me sit so my feet dangled over the hedges. Our hedges, always growing despite the landscaper's best attempts to stop them. In hindsight, it was crazy foolish of us to be up there. I mean, a drop that could break my bones, plus a cocktail of hormones and neurotransmitters were booming through my blood, my brain, my heart. It was exactly the sort of thing I never did, yet all thought and reason and basic Darwinian good sense had shut down in favor of an electric light show in my chest. I thought, I hoped, Jim would ease down beside me, close, touching. He didn't. A chasm of 2 feet spanned between us. Clasping his arms to his chest, he lay back, legs swinging, shingles creaking. The wind swept over us, damp with the closest thing to seasons we ever get here, fragrant with earth and yesterday's rain, with leaves decomposing under the live oaks. No winter here, just one life giving way to another.
"Your hands are warm, Holmes," Jim said eventually, and I realized he had curled his own fingers into fists,
holding in my heat, I wanted to believe. "Yours are cold. Have you considered gloves?" No laugh. He was too wrapped up in his thoughts that night. To cover the embarrassment charging up my cheeks, I mimicked his pose and lay back. Then I hugged my arms to my chest and fixed my eyes on the sky. The heat fled my face as fast as it had come, and in an instant I understood why Jim had put this space between us. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains must be the truth. It must be what's real. And I needed that gap between us to feel it. "I'm sorry, Jean. I know this all sounds so completely unlike me, but that's why I have to tell you, don't you see? I'd never felt anything like it. Not then, and not now. No drug has come close to it. No adventure, no dreamscape. Air beneath my feet, darkness to hug me tight. All with the universe spread above me, speckled and humming and so damned alive that there could only be one outcome from it all. A death foretold, and my intestines on the dusty earth below." Jim's phone buzzed at 9:30. I jolted, lost, almost asleep. He eased it from his pocket.
"An alarm," he explained lazily. "It goes off every night, so I don't miss curfew call at 10.
I swallowed. My mouth was dry. Would he notice? And eased up onto my elbows. "You come here every night, then?" A grunt of acknowledgement as he pushed to his feet, dusted off his hands, and then helped me to rise.
"Your fingers are still cold," I said with a smile.
"And yours are still warm,"
he murmured back, offering a grin of his own. But it wasn't a real one. It wasn't the one I wanted. As before, he guided me across the roof, transitioning from the thwack and creak of ancient wood to the muffled glitter of asphalt, and finally back to my window. Our room was dark, Jean. You were still away, and although I could have asked Jim to join me inside, the formal wouldn't end until 11, I knew he would refuse. Or maybe I simply knew he wouldn't fit inside my cage. He was too big for those walls. Instead, we sat on the windowsill. He faced outward, feet resting on the roof. I faced in, feet atop my desk, atop my calc homework. Music thumped through the windowsill, a beat that suggested YMCA was playing in the gym, accompanied by that torturous dance I know you think is fun. Neither Jim nor I spoke, but unlike the silence before, where the entire universe had cradled me and called me friend, this silence was strained. I could feel the tick of Jim's internal clock, and there was no denying that the bomb attached was about to go off. The breeze kicked at his hair while he picked his thumbnail, a half-hearted movement I didn't have the guts to interrupt. I just watched. I just waited. At last, he shifted toward me, and in that instance, the scrape of his jeans was too loud, too real, too inescapable, and made all the more so by his eyes, rooting on my face, dark behind his glasses. My heart picked up speed, not because I thought he might kiss me, though God knows I wanted him to, but because there was something wrong, something off. "What, James?" I said, harsher than I'd intended, breaking the spell that had fallen over us.